All right, so we are continuing the conversation on the commandments with the fourth and fifth commandment tonight. So you have a handout, a one-page handout with an excerpt from a papal encyclical I will reference midway, and then outline of the slides, so we don't have to spend a lot of time on our general outline, for example. Contextually, we are, I think as Father Peter mentioned last time, in the third part of our course, the third part of the catechism as well, which focuses on the moral life in Christ, so particularly the way that we cooperate with the new life of grace that we profess in the creed and receive in a particular way in the sacramental life. And so it's our response to God's work in us. It's not something that we're doing on our own. I think as Father Hathaway mentioned, there's always a primacy of grace in our life in living out God's plan for morality. I included a paragraph from the Catechism here just to talk quickly about the perspective of Christian morality. So the call to follow Jesus Christ is, as St. Paul mentions, the Catechism in that particular paragraph in your physical copies has footnotes if you wanted to go into the New Testament. St. Paul talks about the call to put on Christ and to live him in a particular way, and so our understanding of the Christian life is that the call to follow Jesus is to allow his holiness to be made present in us in an ever greater way. And so we do talk about commandments and principles in morality, but it's more than just a negative approach. And so I know Father Peter mentioned that he had a slide with a picture of like a roadway and the barriers as an image last time to help. Another image that might be useful, I played a lot of basketball a long time ago, and so you definitely spend the first couple years learning all of the rules of the game, what a double dribble is, what a foul is, 3 seconds, all the stuff that it's questionable whether they call still in the NBA anymore, but the point, though, is not that you just spend your life or you spend your time when you're playing basketball on the court, like counting through your head, oh, I'm not traveling, I'm not standing in the lane for 3 seconds. The goal is to take on these principles, these structures, this framework for the game so that you can enter into it and play it well. And that is the principle for us in the Christian life, that we do talk about commandments, principles, goals, and virtues, and all of that's important. But the point being that we are meant to internalize it and then live it out in a way that expresses the joy, the freedom, and the fullness that God has made us for. So we've talked about commandments 1, 2, and 3 last time, and tonight commandments 4 and 5 focus in a particular way on family relationships, authority in general, and the dignity of human life. Okay, so commandments in general. The Catechism has a beautiful paragraph, 1950, if you have your physical copies, or if not, you can just look it up at some point, that reflects the fact that we view the commandments on a really kind of basic, simple explanation way as the father's rules for his family. Just as every family has guidelines set up by the parents, the Ten Commandments are God the Father's vision for how he wants his family, which really is all of humanity, to live in his house, which in a certain sense is all of the earth, which he's created for us. So we can think of them as God the Father's rules for his family. He began creation, we talked about this in salvation history, with one rule for Adam and Eve, and they struggled with that. So as a result, as things got more difficult for them, more were added. And the Mosaic Law ultimately ended up with some 600 laws. I don't remember the exact number. But the Ten Commandments have a particular place of priority, and I think Father Peter introduced them well last time. Law, as a concept, is a very important theological and philosophical principle. It isn't just some guy in charge who has a particular preference and he expects everybody else to follow it. It is a very intentional principle that is a recognition on the part of the leader of something that's important, that's worthwhile for the whole community to pursue and to follow. And so the Catechism, also in paragraph 1951, points out that law is a rational principle. And so it's really a human principle, a connection between our mind, our intellect, and God's intellect. Animals don't really have laws the way that we do. And so in every law that comes to us from God, from his divine law, we're invited into a dialogue, so to speak, or a questioning as to what the principle is and what God's trying to teach us about creation and about his plan for us in what he's simply commanding in a particular commandment or law. And so each commandment, in fact, points towards some important principle for us in our human life, in our relationship with God for the first three commandments, and then, or in our relationship with other people in the other commandments. And I don't know if Father Peter mentioned it last time, but the commandments, so every aspect, there's a lot of ink that has been spilled over the Our Father in the New Testament as the perfect prayer, and the Ten Commandments in the Old Testament as the perfect structuring of the moral life. Both are very intentional words from God, and so there's no accidents or mistakes in what God gives to us, particularly in those two things. And so even the order of the petitions in the Our Father, for example, is, St. Thomas Aquinas will say, God teaching us about what's most important to pray for, and then to kind of work our way down the order of importance. And the same is true for the Ten Commandments. And so the first three commandments address our relationship with God. The other seven talk about our relationship with other people. And there's a way that God, even as we go through them and memorizing them, is teaching us something about the order or structuring of our love, what is always most important for us, and then what flows from that. Great. Okay. You talked about the four types of law last time, right? So I don't... divine law, eternal law, natural law, and human law. Great. So that is... And then... So in the Old Testament, or when we talk about the fulfillment, Christ fulfills the law. The fair question is raised. So Jesus fulfills the Old Testament, fulfills the law. Does that simply mean that everything we read in the Old Testament, we can then just leave behind because we live in the New Testament? Hopefully the kind of presentation on salvation history shows there's definitely a linear progression, and God doesn't just leave stuff behind. He completes and fulfills it. But when we talk about law in the Bible, in the Old Testament, we can divide it into three different categories. So there were cultural laws for the Jewish people that covered like what types of food they would eat, what it meant to kind of wash or clean themselves, who they could marry, different social norms that they had to follow as God's people. There were liturgical laws that prescribed the different types of sacrifices or offerings that were made if you committed a certain sin or what the priests were supposed to do in the temple as part of their day job. And then there were moral laws. Thou shalt not kill, for example. I mean, the Ten Commandments follow the easiest example of those. So Jesus Christ fulfills all three types of law completely in himself. He takes up all of the liturgical laws and the sacrifices in his own perfect sacrifice on the cross. He, already in his engaging the Pharisees in the Gospels, shows that some of the cultural laws are going to fall away as part of God's plan to grow the human family beyond the simple culture of Israel to all of the human peoples. But he's also very clear in the Gospels that the moral law is fulfilled and, in fact, deepened in a new way through the life of grace. And so the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus' affirmation. There's the whole series of, you have heard that it was said, but I say to you. So he will use something from the old law. And he, in fact, will not say that that's gone. He extends it to a deeper level. So talks about committing adultery versus now looking at someone with lust, having already committed it in your heart. So the moral law in the new covenant is extended now, not just to external actions, but into the heart. That there can be a true transformation that takes place through the work of grace. And so we do talk about the Ten Commandments. The Catechism mentions this as perennial teachings for us that are meant, in fact, to be interiorized and lived in a deeper way in the New Covenant. They don't fall away. There's one other distinction to be made then in the commandments, and this is where the handout hopefully will at least be helpful. So there are two types of commandments. You may have picked this up already in the first three. I am the Lord your God. Do not have strange gods or idols before me. That's a prohibition. Do not take the name of the Lord your God in vain is a prohibition. Do not do this. And then the third commandment is to remember to keep the Sabbath or the Lord's Day holy. So there's a distinction between telling someone not to do something, don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain, and telling someone to do something positively, to keep holy the Sabbath. So we can make this distinction between negative precepts, don't do this, and positive precepts in the commandments, do this. Now, most of the commandments are negative, don't do this, but there are a few positive ones. The fourth commandment, for example, is one. And so I included two paragraphs from an encyclical written by St. John Paul II about 30 years ago, which is just a masterpiece on new morality or morality in the modern age. And so without going into church history, after the Second Vatican Council, there were a lot of changes in the church, and there was a desire to express the faith in a new way. And the question was raised because in previous generations, there hadn't always been a good explanation for some of the things that the church taught, as to whether a lot of the things that the church had said, God doesn't want us to do this, we're going to change. And so he wrote this incredible work, encyclical, just reaffirming the tradition that when God says don't do something, that is done in a way that isn't changing. And so the paragraphs there talk about the distinction between positive and negative precepts. And he mentions that all of the commandments apply universally for us. They're perennial. We don't just forget about them or change based on the age. But a positive commandment requires a practical application that can look different in different circumstances. And he says there is always more that can be done in a positive commandment. With a negative commandment, it is outlining what is a minimum limit, so you can't go below what's forbidden. And it carves out something that always goes, an action that goes against human dignity, so against the way that God has made us to operate in a particular way. So thou shalt not bear false witness. God has made us as human beings to seek truth, to know truth, and that to choose to not tell the truth in a situation is in fact something that goes against human dignity and the capacity that we have to know and judge truth. Just the point being that the negative ones are treated slightly differently than the positive ones, commandment-wise, as the negative ones give us something that's going to be a minimum line that we can't cross in how we apply those to our daily life. Any questions about that? Last year, everybody was like, you did not explain that well, so I want to take a quick moment here. The whole encyclical is great, but those two paragraphs address that, and it's a fair question. Certainly, all the commandments are universally valid and timeless for us. But it's cool as human beings. There's a difference, even as a parent, right? If a parent says, I don't know, go clean your room, that looks different from don't go out after 8 p.m. There's a little bit more of a clarity and a definitiveness to don't go out after 8 p.m. versus help your mom or clean your room, which looks like, well, what are we looking at? So we recognize that. The church is not denying that. And there's, in fact, a purpose behind that in what God is communicating to us. Great. So with that, we're going to dive in to the fourth commandment. Okay. Fourth commandment from the book of Exodus, taken directly from Exodus 20:12, says, honor your father and mother, that your days may be long in the land which the Lord your God gives you. So literally, it prescribes that we give honor or respect to our parents. Positive prescription, so we just talked about those two. Going beyond saying simply just don't be disrespectful or disobedient to your parents. So there's a good example. God doesn't say, don't disobey your parents, don't disrespect your parents. He says, in fact, honor your father and mother, pointing us towards something that looks different in different cultures and different historical eras. It's also just an amazing moment because it's the only commandment that includes a promise from God about blessing here and now. So that your days may be long in the land which the Lord your God gives you. So certainly he's referring in some sense to the promised land, but there's also a timelessness to it. So it's an amazing thought that continues for us even in the new covenant. Okay, so the principle behind it, what is God teaching us about human nature? Particularly that relationships matter, that God makes his own being, his Trinitarian communion, shine forth to us in the relationships between family members. And so there's something so sacred and important about that, that he in fact wants it to be structured or guided in a particular way so that it can reflect something of his very being. And so in honoring our father and mother, we honor God himself. So relationships matter, and this commandment, and so the catechism does this well. I don't know, Father Peter probably didn't mention this, but you may have picked up last time. The catechism will list the commandment if you've done reading. Have you done any of the reading under the on the commandments yet? So it's really cool. It lists the commandment, and then it goes through kind of the principles behind it, and then all of the ways that that commandment actually can be applied to daily life. So they're not just these sort of abstract things. And so some of the things that Father Peter went through, and like, what does it mean to have another God? That, you know, superstitious activities, you know, whatever it is, those, like, the catechism kind of goes through, and it's like, ooh, wow, I never connected that particular thing to the bigger picture of the commandment. So topics that this commandment relates to would be family life, our relationships with authority, and the role of society. So this is also the commandment, I forgot to put this on here, that would govern or guide the whole principle of government in society, social order and authority. So we'll talk about that briefly. Scriptural foundations for the principle of this commandment. St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians. For this reason, I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven on earth is named. So St. Paul is pointing to the fact that God's fatherhood is the source of all earthly fatherhood, and so respecting our earthly fatherhood and authority structures is in some way a respect that we give to God, who is the source. The book of Sirach says, with all your heart, honor your father and mother. What can you give them back that equals their gift to you? So it echoes that commandment from earlier in Exodus, and then offers the little thought kind of project, what can we give back for the gift of our own life and the care that we received as totally dependent, helpless children. So, Gospel of Matthew, Jesus, in fact, uses the example of parenthood when speaking to his disciples, saying that if you who are wicked know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your heavenly Father give good things to those who ask him? So Jesus makes use of our human experience of fatherhood and family life to begin to teach us something about God the Father's perfect care for us. We see in our Lord's own life there in the Gospel of Luke that Jesus intentionally, it's noted, went back to Nazareth and was obedient to his parents, Mary reflecting on these things in her heart. And then St. Paul is going to hint for us, or just directly reveal, the fact that this commandment also connects to our role in civil society or civil government when he says that let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. So all authority in some way is a reflection of God's ultimate authority and perfect authority over creation. And so there's a call to respect that, and certainly for those in authority to reflect something of God's love. Okay, so the family itself then. Honor thy father and mother. I mentioned that the family has a particular role in God's plan. We talked about that probably a little bit back in Genesis, but three important principles that the family as a unit or communion, the catechism says, is something that's established by God. And so in creating man and woman, God instituted the human family and endowed it with its fundamental constitution. Its members are persons who are equal in dignity. For the common good of its members and society, the family necessarily has manifold responsibilities, rights, and duties. So every family as a unit has rights, responsibilities, and duties. And the catechism will talk about how the family, like the government and society, is meant to help support families. But even within family life, there are different rights, responsibilities, and duties as there are different roles. And so the catechism is highlighting that within a communion of persons, whether it's the family or on a larger scale society, different roles mean different responsibilities and different rights. So this communion of persons then is a particular reflection of God's image and work. In paragraph 2205, the catechism notes that the family is a communion of persons, a sign and image of the communion of God the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. In procreation and education of children, the family reflects the Father's work of creation. So there is a way that God's being is reflected in the life of a family, and his work of bringing life into existence and then nurturing it and caring for it. So the principle of creation is not just that God brings things into existence and then walks away. The same is true for parents who, in their love, care, and education of their children, reflect something of God's role. The Catechism says that the family as a unit exists prior to any civil recognition. So a little bit like the principle of marriage as something that exists long before any government decided to state what marriage was or to give it particular rights. Marriage and family are institutions that have been created by God and written into the fabric of society, sort of like the law into the fabric of creation, sort of like the laws of gravity. And the Catechism articulates that even further than in paragraph 2207, calling it the cell of social life. St. John Paul II there in that brief line, and a letter at some point to, I think it was Australia, said that as the family goes, so goes the world. That a renewal of world, a renewal of society really takes place within family life. And the Catechism has a couple of other paragraphs that talk about the environment that parents are meant to build in the home, because children spend a majority of their time there, is the most formative part of their life, and certainly in preparing them for adulthood and entrance into society. And so it is family life that, in fact, shapes the future leaders and the next generation everywhere. Okay, so then there are duties. If that's the vision of what family life should be or is meant to be in God's plan, then there are particular duties. And so the Catechism goes through the duties of children in the family. In 2251, it notes that respect for parents on the part of children derives from gratitude towards those by whose gift of life and love and work they have brought their children into the world and enabled them to grow in stature, wisdom, and grace. The Catechism certainly notes that this respect and honor, shown first by docility and obedience, it says, on the part of the children to their parents, as long as they are in their parents' home. So that's a fun little well-thought-out caveat. I don't know if any of you have adult or older children, but the Catechism says as long as they're in your home, they have a particular duty of respect and obedience. Certainly, yeah, that changes then as they move out and extends over the course of a life. The Catechism does note that certainly that duty of obedience and respect doesn't mean that there's an absolute right on the part of parents to order their children to do something, for example, that would be against God's law. And so there is always a higher law, back in those four types of law. God's law is always the highest. And so a particular order from a parent to a child that would go against God's law is not something that should be followed or would need to be followed in the principle of obedience and respect under this commandment. The Catechism notes that respect and honor for parents looks different then as children grow up and move out of the house, but does continue in a very real way into old age. So respect, prayer for your parents, and then support as reasonably possible, given the circumstances of wherever you may be logistically and in life. On the part of parents then, so the fact that parents have a particular authority over their children means that they have a particular responsibility in care for them. And so the Catechism in paragraph 2221 speaks about the fact that parents are required to give children moral and spiritual education, that it isn't just providing for physical needs or getting them off to school to make sure that they learn math, literature, but as human persons, having a moral and spiritual dimension, that is in fact also part of a parent's responsibility. And the Catechism notes that will always begin by their example. So that's, a great reminder for all of us that example is always the first way in which we teach others, especially children. I am constantly humbled as a priest who visits our school regularly that it is 50% of what I say, but 50% of what I do. Just as a quick story, we have a small chapel in the school with the Blessed Sacrament, and there's a small candle for the tabernacle. So if you've been in our church, you've seen the same sanctuary lamp. And like on the first day of school, I always bring it to visit the kindergartners. And I explain what it is. I explain that we have Jesus here in the school. It's a really amazing thing. And the teachers then usually say, well, I ask them first to let me know if the candle ever goes out. So they're sort of like my scouts, and they're really diligent. But I tell them that because Jesus is there, as we walk by the chapel, if we see the candle on, we know he's in his home, and we can just do a little sign of respect, maybe, you know, a bow or a sign of the cross. So there was one day where must have just been totally zoned out. I was multitasking, and I walked by the chapel without making a sign of acknowledgement for Jesus. And there were some kindergartners that must have seen it because I visited a classroom the next couple weeks and they were like, why did Jesus leave? And I was like, I don't think he's left. No, he's there. And they were like, well, you didn't make a sign of the cross. And I was like, oh gosh. So I was like, you're right. That's my fault. He's there. I was not at the time. And so it's just, a very humbling reminder. And that usually happens once a year, at least, that it is at least as much what we do when we are, in the presence of little ones. And so for parents, yes, it's important to say the right thing, but it's also important to live the right thing, and children certainly recognize that. And so the Catechism just mentions that as a really beautiful and real principle, that education and care for children begins with a parent's own good example. And then it has a couple of really beautiful paragraphs there after that last number, just about the environment or the culture that the church envisions a home being, that because it is the place where children spend so much of their early and formative years, that it is a place where they're meant to learn to be generous with others, to forgive, a sense of duty, a sense of concern and care for those in need, even just beyond the family, generous service, love for the Lord. They're meant to learn how to pray in the home. And so it's just a beautiful thing. And I tell a lot of the couples that are engaged in getting ready to get married and start their own families that they can kind of think of themselves as co-founders of a startup company. In the sense that, like we love startups today, it's kind of all the rage. And culture in startup companies matter. And so it really comes from what the co-founders or the founding members want it to be. And I'm like, you have a blank slate, but you have to build that culture yourselves. And not blank slate in the sense that the church doesn't want to help, it's just that it's up to you. And so that is something that parents have a responsibility for. And it says as well then that they're meant to direct the children towards their ultimate good, to recognize that God and his law is the most important and greatest thing and the greatest gift that we have. And their leadership is meant to reflect that. There's also, a paragraph, did I put it in here? Nope. That parents are required to, that discipline is an important thing for children, a reflection of God's care for us, and that it's meant to be done in a proper way, so there's plenty of ways that can go, wrong, but that it is an important part of a child's formation, and that parents are meant to see and respect the dignity of the human person, really the gift that human life is, in each of their children. And so certainly that prevents any sort of excessive disciplinarian or harsh structure. So it's a beautiful section. The point being that there are duties of children that are particularly detailed when they're young and at home that change but still exist as a child grows and leaves the house. And then authority and that role that parents have, reflecting something of God's perfect authority, means that there's in fact a responsibility on the part of those in authority and in charge to care for the ones under them, to lead by example, and to promote an environment that serves everyone in the family. Okay, so those are all principles that can then be applied on a larger scale to our life and society. So the Catechism in that section on the fourth commandment makes this bridge from talking about family life specifically to the role of society in general and government. And it mentions there in paragraph 2212 that it's family relationships that illuminate the other relationships in society. Sorry, I didn't write that out fully. And the principle in family life, but then also in society, that right relationships goes beyond just rights and duties. That in the Christian life, we do recognize responsibilities. So as a parent, you have a responsibility to give your child food. But there's more to a healthy family life than just doing the minimum or saying, what is my responsibility to this person? And the same is true in society as well, that there are responsibilities, duties, and rights. But in a Christian society, we're meant to go beyond just the minimum. And so those are two important points in bridging this vision for family life and its principles into the larger picture of society. So the Catechism then in paragraph 2235 talks about civil government, recognizing that it's measured in terms of its divine origin. So as St. Paul writes, and we read there, that all authority in some way reflects God's ultimate authority. And so as Jesus says in the Gospels, render to Caesar what is Caesar's, acknowledging this temporal role of civil government, that it should be reasonable, certainly, and it should direct those under it towards the common good. It is wrong, and so civil authority cannot or must not command something contrary to the dignity of the person or divine and natural law. So as good of a principle as civil government is, a natural principle for human beings, like the principle that parents are not able or should not command their children to do something against God's law out of authority, so too a government is meant to promote the common good of all of its citizens. And it would be against that to command something that's against God's law. And so God's law is always this overarching framework or structure for all of society to be guided by. And that would be whether they're Christian or not, because we could talk about the fact that the principles in the Ten Commandments are there, not just according to God's divine law, but also natural law, that there's something in them that reflects that. And it also mentions in, what's a great paragraph, 2236, that laws, in fact, teach. So that principle that law is an ordinance of reason. And so a government's laws should teach its citizens, in fact, to organize what's most important in their life. A just hierarchy of values, it says, that law is meant to help make people better and to make society better, to protect those weakest members, and to help form the people in society. So you should be able to ask why we have a law and what that's meant to help us do or grow or become in a very real sense. So I'm sure the lawyers love that. Okay. For citizens, then, that's the part of those in authority. For citizens, the Catechism lists that we all, as citizens, have a duty to contribute to society, so that's paragraph 2239, in a spirit of truth, justice, solidarity, and freedom. So the love and service of one's country follow from the duty of gratitude and belongs to the order of charity. Submission to the legitimate authorities and service of the common good require citizens to fulfill their roles in the life of the political community. So the Catechism tells us that as Christians, we can't just check out of society, even if there are problems, that we do have a duty and a debt of gratitude to society for the goods that we're able to receive from it. It specifically says that paying taxes, voting, and defending the country are three important applications of that. And so, that's 2240. We mentioned that line from St. Paul, which to extend it even further, in chapter 13 of his letter to the Romans, he says, "For the same reason you also pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Pay all of them their dues, taxes to whom taxes are due, revenue to whom revenue is due, respect to whom respect is due, and honor to whom honor is due." And then the Catechism mentions particularly that if a civil authority, for example, were to overstep their duties and to command something or to promote something that goes against God's law, citizens are obliged in conscience not to follow the directive that would go against God's law and to give witness to the fact that there is a higher law, that's a higher purpose and a higher structure. St. Peter, for example, in Acts 5:29, when the civil government tells him to stop preaching the gospel, says, "I do have to obey God rather than men." So he has no problem obeying civil authorities in their proper structure, but should they prevent him, for example, from sharing his faith, he recognizes the higher law. This principle, then, of family life and generosity extended to large society shapes a little bit of Christian charity between nations. And so there's a section in the Catechism with a couple of paragraphs outlining, so in paragraph 2241, that the more prosperous nations are obliged, to the extent that they are able, to welcome foreigners in search of security and a means of livelihood, which they may not be able to find in their country of origin. Public authorities should see to it that the natural right is respected, that places a guest under the protection of those who receive him. Political authorities, for the sake of the common good for which they are responsible, may make the exercise of the right to immigrate subject to various juridical conditions, especially with regard to the immigrants' duties toward their country of adoption. Immigrants are obliged to respect with gratitude the material and spiritual heritage of the country that receives them, to obey the laws, and to assist in carrying out civic burdens. So the Christian principle of charity, the Catechism says, begins certainly at home, but applies to some degree on a larger scale. Countries that have surplus and the ability to help others should do so to the ability that they can. It is particularly important to allow those who are in need or in particularly difficult situations to immigrate. But the Catechism says that government has a right to control or to guide that process according to the common good. So, those are all principles outlined there. Okay. Questions on the fourth commandment. So that's kind of a quick walkthrough. Principle starts with the family, reflection of God, communion of persons, responsibilities and duties, but certainly goes beyond that, meant to be a communion of love. That principle applies on the larger scale to government, civil society, duties and responsibilities, authority. It needs to be respected and obeyed, but in doing so has a particular responsibility to guide those under it towards what's truly good, to help form them and shape them. And has a particular, we'll talk about this in the next commandment, has a particular responsibility when it fails to do so. So it's not good when somebody does something wrong. It's really not good when a leader does something wrong, because there's a way that they're, as the little story of kindergartners, their example means a lot more. So, okay. Questions now? Great. Or, yeah, totally open. All right. So, fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill. So back to Exodus chapter 20, verse 13 now. Very short. In fact, one of the shorter verses in the Bible. Thou shalt not kill. I am not a Hebrew scholar, but my seminary professors pointed out that in the original Hebrew, there are different words for kill, and the one that's used here refers to an intentional taking of innocent life. So murder would be the most accurate translation, which is kind of helpful as we're going to get into some principles of self-defense and other things in here. Thou shalt not kill, yeah, clear, easy, but there is nuance even in the original Hebrew, is the point that my seminary professors were making. Unlike the fourth commandment, this is a negative prohibition. So simple, low bar, don't take innocent life. The principle behind it is the dignity and the true fact that God alone is the source and author of life, the only one who controls it. And so topics that would be covered under this commandment certainly include the taking of innocent life in a bunch of different ways. We talk a lot about the respect for the dignity of the human person, so it's forbidden to disrespect the dignity of the person, both in body and soul. So that's an important way that we can unpack that. And then this will also talk about conflict between nations, the principle of self-defense. So, okay. Scriptural principles or scriptural passages that reflect this principle beyond just the book of Exodus. All the way back in Genesis, we hear the Lord speaking to Cain. What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground, and now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood. So a recognition immediately of the first murder and the punishment for that particular wrong. Even further, then in Genesis, God says, for your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. He's speaking to Cain here. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. for God has made man in his own image. And so you're already seeing, actually directly from God in the conversation, the principle that life is something that comes from God alone, and the only one who can claim a right to it, to take it, is God. Psalm 139, beautifully used many times in the pro-life movement. For it was you who formed my inward parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. A recognition of God's providential care and gift of life long before birth into the world. Gospel of Matthew, Jesus speaks about hatred in a person's heart. So this is in the midst of the Sermon on the Mount, and actually a great example of what I was talking about earlier about our Lord fulfilling and deepening the moral law from the Old Covenant. Jesus says, so you have heard that you said, you shall not kill, but I say to you that anyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment, and whoever says you fool will be liable to the hell of fire. So we'll talk about the further or the interior application of this commandment, thou shalt not kill. And then 1 John 3:15, anyone who hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. So in summary, we can say that life is a sacred gift from God, that man does not have the authority to take it. Each human person is the result of God's loving care and therefore has dignity, and that the principle of this commandment extends beyond just murdering someone, as Jesus reveals to us in the Sermon on the Mount, that hatred and the desire for another's death would be included in a serious sin against this principle. Okay, so we're going to talk about a lot of the different ways that the Catechism explains this commandment can be applied to daily life today. It can get a little heavy because we talk about death and taking life, so just as a fair warning. It can also get a little heavy because sometimes there are ways, maybe that we didn't realize, that our actions would have fallen under this commandment, or that other people in our lives have experienced something that we're going to talk about in some way. So the goal, is not to make this depressing. Jesus saves, but we'll just work through some of these things. It's always his good news, of the forgiveness and healing that he wants to bring. All right, so the Catechism in paragraph 2258 just points us towards the positive principle behind this commandment. When it says that human life is sacred because from its beginning it involves the creative action of God, and it remains forever a special relationship with the Creator, who is its sole end. God alone is the Lord of life from its beginning until its end, and no one can, under any circumstance, claim for himself the right to directly destroy an innocent human being. So the commandment directly forbids murder. Thou shalt not kill or murder. And the Catechism says that, the easiest or direct application of this is the fact that intentionally taking an innocent life is always gravely sinful. The Catechism says that this includes what it calls a passive cause. So any action with the intention of indirectly bringing about a person's death, such as exposing them to mortal danger, so driving at 1,000 miles an hour while you're texting on your cell phone, for example, would be putting the passenger in your car. Sorry, added detail, you have a passenger in your car, is putting them in mortal danger. Or it says refusing assistance to someone in need. So walking by someone who's drowning, you have a little floaty and you're like, oh, I'm busy and I'm just walking away, would also be a way in which you're choosing to not help a person in need who could end up losing their life because of your omission to help. The Catechism says that this commandment certainly applies to all points of human life, beginning to its end. And so at the beginning of life, one of the ways that this commandment could be violated is through abortion. Direct abortion, it says in paragraph 2271. The church has letters from bishops dating all the way back to the first century that recognize the dignity of unborn life. And professing that as Christians, we are called to live differently from the surrounding culture, which certainly didn't see life as particularly valuable, especially in Roman cultures, until after birth, the father would accept the child. So we have letters from very early on pointing to the dignity of even unborn life. Right, okay. Direct abortion, it says either willed as an end or a means is always morally wrong. Discarding frozen embryos would also be something that comes under this commandment, as we know both from faith and then on the material, so spiritually from faith, or on the spiritual side of the soul, we know from theology, but on the material side from the body, we know that the moment of fertilization is the moment in which the unique DNA strand is formed, and so that's the moment the soul is created. So the moment of fertilization is the moment life begins. And so frozen embryos